live human hostages are not, is not data, to state the obvious. Data is different. I mean, the most obvious of all is no one's going to lose their life or be physically harmed most of the time, right? With data only. So it's a different set of motivations off the bat. And so we found the best ransomware negotiators are the ones that have a good understanding of the criminal enterprise of the ransomware ecosystem. In other words, the affiliate models and the different technologies and the different threat actor groups that were selling the technology, et cetera.
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cyber Insurance Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Hess. Stay tuned.
Good morning and good afternoon, Stu Panensky. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anthony. Been looking forward to being here.
Cool, cool. Well, happy to have you. I'd like to kick things off by just letting people know a bit about yourself and your practice and your company. You know, you've done a lot of exciting stuff around starting a new firm. But let's start with you. Why don't you just tell us about yourself?
I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm Stu Panensky. I'm a partner at the Pearson Ferdinand Law Firm. They work in the cyber privacy and technology practice group there. And what we do is work with organizations when they experience either cybersecurity or data privacy events. And we help them through those events. We help them identify legal issues. And we help them comply with those issues if they have any. And we just try to get them the tools that they need to get them where they need to be. We provide both the wartime services, which are, you know, the incident response that I just described, as well as we defend against lawsuits that arise out of those types of issues. And then we also do the peacetime services, where we counsel organizations and businesses when they're preparing for events, or they're addressing their own cybersecurity needs or their data privacy needs. So we do the website compliance, the T's and C's. We do incident response planning. We do bug bounty programs for software providers, et cetera. I love this area of the law. I feel very fortunate to be able to do this every single day.
Fantastic. Is there any size or sector of clients in particular that you focus on?
No, not really. We've represented clients in every single industry sector, I believe. We have some incidental areas of focus where we've received more than others. For example, professional services seems to be an area where we industry sector where we get a lot of assignments regarding healthcare is another one that comes to mind. Technology is another one that comes to mind. And Pearson Ferdinand, my law firm, is a national law firm, and it's a full services law firm. So it's not just cyber and privacy. It's also all corporate litigation and IP. So we really can offer businesses a full 360-degree suite of services. And Pearson Ferdinand is a brand new law firm. We just launched on January 1st. And as we're fond of telling everyone, it's been reported to us that it's the largest law firm launch in U.S. history. So we're very proud.
Really? That's I didn't actually know that. That's really cool. Really exciting.
Thank you.
So, you know, usually sometimes I skip the geography question that I like to ask, just because most U.S. law firms are quite U.S. focused, obviously. But would you say there's a balance between U.S. and maybe international cases, or what are you seeing on that front?
We do both U.S. and international cases. Yes, I would say the majority of our cases are in the U.S., where my group is based in the U.S. Our law firm does have presence in EU and UK, and we're in growth mode. We also have affiliated law firms that we partner with when we do have areas with cross-border issues that arise. So if one of our clients is doing business internationally, we have relationships and partnerships with law firms in those jurisdictions. So we would be able to provide continuous services for the entire world, even though we're based in the US.
Okay. Fantastic. What would you say your company's strength is? I think you kind of maybe hinted at it, but let me ask the question anyways.
Yeah, no, I'll take that layup. Pearson Ferdinand is a really exciting law firm. First of all, we're a distributed law firm. That means that our partners mostly work from either virtual offices or their home offices. That allows us to have a very wide footprint. We have presence in 20 to 30 US states and growing. And additionally, it's a brand new law firm. So we have a really incredible technology stack that we were able to design to maximize the experience of both the partners that use the technology and the clients that will receive the services. So we had the opportunity to know that this was going to be a large endeavor and to design the technology stack accordingly.
It's it's interesting. There's definitely some parallels with ourselves, you know, kind of starting after the COVID era. You know, you can build a different kind of company.
100% agree. I think COVID opened up a lot of folks' minds about what's possible with business. Mm-hmm. And it's not for everybody.
Yeah.
And we understand a lot of services or businesses that need a brick and mortar presence. Totally respect that. But with the practice of law in this day and age, we believe we can offer something different.
Yeah, no, that's cool. We're exciting. But so what I like to do for kind of the next stage of the interview, I love to dig into kind of some of the thought leadership questions and get your views on different things. I love opinions. So I'd love to pull out what you think on a lot of things. So I guess one of the interesting things we've talked about in the past was kind of information sharing. You know, there's a lot of conversation, confusion, different viewpoints in terms of all the different parties you might find in a cyber claim. We've got kind of a law firm, the digital forensics firm, we've got the insurer, you've got the insured, you've got these different parties, and there's maybe different concepts on information sharing between those parties. What are some of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I've heard different opinions on that from different attorneys. So I think maybe people have different views on this, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. I think the goal for a lot of lawyers when they are getting involved in an incident response is to try to maximize the client's ability to avail itself of the attorney-client privilege and refuse to disclose information some later proceeding. Mm-hmm. And those considerations are challenging when other parties are involved, as you pointed out. There's a lot of law that suggests that there's the more people that know about something, the less of an expectation you would have that something's going to be kept confidential. And so we do what we can in the contracts and in the building of the incident response decision-making to try to maximize the ability for the client to argue that something was privileged and then not produce it in some future date. This is a tough area of the law that is not settled. Okay. So facts, for example, it's been said are not privileged. Well, digital forensics firm, what are they doing there? These are tricky issues.
Yeah.
And so information sharing is a big part of that. So at least from the most basic level, we like to be the buffer or go-between as outside counsel, at least to demonstrate an effort to keep things confidential or privileged. Mm-hmm. And so we would ask our vendors that we work with, we get into three-party agreements with them, where it's our law firm retaining the service provider to provide services on behalf of the client. And then we ask the service provider to report to us, the law firm, and then we would report to the client. And so information sharing should be an issue that does get addressed during the incident response in the early stage. Let the counsel should sort of explain to the client and the service providers how it should work. Explain to them that this is meant to maximize their opportunities later to argue that something's privileged and go from there. And then you throw the case, you asked about the carrier. For the law firm, this is an interesting issue. It's the policy holder that's really the fiduciary client. They're the ones that get the services. But it's the insurer that is the one introducing us typically to the policyholder. It's the insurer that finances much of the assignment. They're what's considered a third-party payor under the law. And so you have to be mindful with how your attorney ethical obligations are in information sharing between the policyholder, the carrier, and the law firm. That's called the tripartite relationship. And every state has its own body of law, in the U.S. anyway, has its own body of law about how the tripartite relationship should work. Counsel should basically be mindful of that issue.
Yeah, I think it's when you really start digging into some of these, it is really interesting. You know, you tend to hear a lot of law firms kind of at a high level just say, oh, attorney-client privilege, oh, we have to be involved for this reason or that reason. I think when you really dig into the details like we are, it is interesting because you're like, oh, yeah, I can see why we'd have to do it this way or that way. And it's nice to have that expert kind of involved in it. You know, it's at a high level, it doesn't, because of the reasons we talked about, right? You're like, well, these are mostly just facts anyways. But once you start getting into the details, it's like, right, well, in this situation, we should do this or we should do that to kind of maintain, you know, the way these relationships all need to work. So it's nice to have that. Well, cool. Well, I guess kind of going to another question, you know, we've been, you know, kind of ransomware negotiations. It is kind of interesting the different approaches that people have taken. You know, I see some companies, and this is the, I'll be honest, this is the probably the way it works for us. Like, we've just had people who have come up in the industry and gained experience doing ransomware negotiations. We haven't, at least to date, hired anyone who's kind of a hostage negotiator or something, you know, bring them on and just kind of retrain them. I see companies doing that as well. I don't know. What are your thoughts? Like, what do you like to see in a negotiation, and what kind of background do you really like to see, or what kind of background do you think is needed?
Great question. And this is an area I love to talk about. We have a lot of opinions on ransomware incident response handling. You got to start somewhere. So where did they go? They went to law enforcement, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's an observation. I'm not I don't know at all. My observation, having to hire a lot of these folks and introduce them to my clients. And if we see a lot of law enforcement or retired law enforcement, and we heard, especially in the beginning, a lot of boasting about going to, because you said about the hostage negotiation school that federal law enforcement offers. It's incredible. But it's different. Live human hostages is not data, to state the obvious. It's not data. Data is different. I mean, the most obvious of all is no one's going to lose their life or be physically harmed most of the time, right? With data only. So it's a different set of motivations off the bat.
Yeah.
And so we found the best ransomware negotiators are the ones that have a good understanding of the criminal enterprise of the ransomware ecosystem. In other words, the affiliate models and the different technologies and the different threat actor groups that were selling the technology, et cetera. Some good threat intelligence. So a good ransomware negotiator has good threat intelligence. And then also an understanding that this is not a hostage negotiation. This is business. And in business negotiations, sure, the leverages are different, obviously, because someone's holding your company for extortion, for digital extortion, but they want to get paid.
Yeah.
And if you have cyber insurance, you have a pot of money to pay them with or not. And so that's the decision made. If you start from that premise, I think the negotiation gets much further along because you understand that a lot of that early stuff doesn't have to go forward. So instead, the negotiations are really about what's the valuation of the data. If you're going in that direction, if it's about what you've encrypted and you've interrupted our operations, essentially how much does it cost to get the tools. So we find that the folks like Aceris are really the best negotiators, because there's only one way to get this experience, and that's by doing it.
It makes sense too. I think the risk tolerance, like you're implying, is so different too, right? Like, as you say, it's a business negotiation. Nobody's going to lose their lives. You can maybe push a little harder in some circumstances, spend a little less time, maybe getting to know the hostage taker, you know, as it is.
We had one where it was a chat room, you know, so you sort of picture a chat room. So it just said, you know, 8 Bitcoin. And we said, oh, that's outrageous. You know, you will never pay that. And it was very, you know, and then it just said 8 Bitcoin. And we said, come on, you know, look at the documents you stole. We don't have that kind of money. You know, this is crazy. And we just say, you know, 8 Bitcoin. And then eventually we would say, all right, the most we're ever going to come up with is, you know, 1 Bitcoin. And then it was 7.5 Bitcoin. They did not engage in any discussion whatsoever. And the other thing is they forget about you the minute they move on to the next chat window. And that's something else you should be mindful of when you get into this. This is a volume business for them as much as it is for everybody.
You know, something else we've chatted about, sort of policy development. I think it's fun for me. Like, I can relate to a lot of smaller business customers, you know, people that are buying insurance. Like, I because I kind of sit on both sides of it, right? And so I get where a lot of these companies are coming from. What's your IR plan? You know, what's your climate change plan? How are you, you know, making sure you have a diverse workforce, all these kinds of things that for larger companies, you know, maybe would be a bit different. I know I've said, yes, I have used templates before and customized them and whatnot. You know, I think LLMs and AI and whatnot gives you a way to accelerate the development of these things. What are your thoughts? Like, can't you just save a lot of money doing it that way?
Well, the short answer to your question is yes. But this comment arose out of a conversation you and I had about the use of templates. And you asked me, well, what do companies do that they shouldn't do? And I said, use templates.
Right.
And what I meant, we were talking about the peacetime services. We were talking about like website policies, where you're disclosing your practices with the use and collection of your customer's personal data.
Okay.
Don't use a template.
Right? Yeah.
Your business is not the same as someone else's business.
Yeah.
It's not. Now, let's talk to your other question about the LLMs and Gen AI. You can get a really good first draft.
Yeah.
You can get a really good first draft using those tools, but it's all it is. It's just a first draft. If you just copy paste, you know, the old control C, control V,
insert company here.
So you're a well-known social media personality, Anthony. And you and I both post a lot on LinkedIn. Mm. I don't know if you've had this experience, but you're scrolling on your feed and you see someone post something that you know was copy and pasted from Gen AI.
Yes.
And you're like, come on, dude.
Right. Because you recognize it. You're like, that's not their style. Because you can
recognize it. Right. So I would just, it's a great first draft engine, but it's not the secret sauce.
Yeah, good point. Well, it's funny for me because I think people probably see a couple different kinds of posts from me. There's sort of the professional posts that you can tell have been thought through, reviewed, like it's proper and professional. And then you get me walking, I'm on the train, I'm walking down the street, like typing random things into my phone. It's like, you can see a difference. If it's ever Gen AI, I think it'd be pretty noticeable. Haven't done it yet. I did actually. Sorry, you know what? I did. I swear, actually, one of my posts, I did feed it through ChatGPT, I think. But it came out so, I had to change it all. It just wasn't my style. I didn't like it. I'm too possessive over. Yeah, I guess I'm just too possessive in general. Even my proper professional posts that have been reviewed and, you know, I had other people look at them and whatnot. Like, they're still me. Like, they've still gone through me. They're just maybe a little bit more professional than the other ones where I just kind of like randomly post opinions. More thought out, more structured when I say
you need both. I think if you're going to play on LinkedIn, you need a healthy mix of both those sort of, you know, one-off opinions about posts about stuff, and then deep level subject matter expertise. You need a little bit of both.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, cool. Let me keep going then. So I was just looking at, so it's kind of, you know, we talked a bit about ransomware. I guess the other big claim type is BEC, business email compromise. And, you know, I think there's kind of from that, the investigation's so cheap nowadays. Like, I think all the best people in this space are really aggressive about automation, really aggressive about developing a high quality investigation at what I think is a super low price. You know, but you still get kind of big data mining losses, I guess, if you need to do data mining, but it's not very frequent off of BEC. But financial fraud's a big one, right? And that's where I think, you know, people really get stung. Is there some way that we could be looking at mitigating financial fraud other than what we're doing so far?
Yeah, that is an interesting area. It's a growth area in the sense that we get a lot more questions or claims that arise out of that wire fraud loss, where some organization is socially engineered or otherwise duped into misdirecting funds to a fraudster. And there's a bunch of money that gets lost. And so the question then arises is, who's responsible for that loss? Is it the person who had the business email compromise, who was sending out funny looking emails? Or is it the party that actually sent the funds to the wrong place? Or is it both? As a lawyer, I will happily on your podcast punt with the answer of it depends. So the other issue that we've asked our carriers to start, or carrier clients to start thinking about, is an alternative way to resolve those issues other than lawsuits and hiring lawyers to resolve the claims, especially when there's two different insurers on either side of that issue. It seems to me that that would be a great opportunity for some sort of inter-insurer alternative dispute resolution process that would be pretty easy. I think that would be pretty easy to govern and to resolve disputes that arise out of those wire fraud losses, because that is a growth area.
Yeah, I would certainly seems like there's a lot of savings that could be made by, you know, not having to take things, you know, much further, take it into mediation or take it into court. So that makes sense. I think there's a lot just in that part of claims in general, you know, whether it's subrogation or you know, it's kind of a bit what you're talking about, you know, where you could just make it work a lot better. It's just it's probably a relatively emerging area, so people haven't really had time to implement a lot of it yet.
It's still a relatively new peril for the insurance world, for sure. And
yeah,
they're getting better and more efficient all the time. And I think that's an exciting area of insurance, commercial insurance, that you don't get in a lot of other lines.
Yeah. It's, I guess I'm not enough familiar with things outside of cyber. Like I'm really into cyber insurance, but the things I know about insurance are so based on my background in cyber. It's definitely, I mean, I've been working in cyber insurance a long time now, but I still am a little bit stuck, like looking at what's going on in cyber. So I don't know if it's super different, but it feels like, I guess coming from the position of being focused on cyber, I like the fact that it's these MGAs or these other small syndicates or whatever, like, you know, they're coming in and they're able to do something pretty unique. And there's a lot of innovation around that, you know, with tech, different tech ways of doing tech, different ways of, you know, modeling things or whatever. So that's kind of exciting.
InsurTech's a very exciting space. I'm a huge nerd, in case you can't tell. So I can keep my eye on the InsurTech world. I'm always looking for the, you know, some cool new spin on claims or adjustment or whatever, actuarial analysis. Yeah. I love it all.
Yeah. Well, it's not just someone coming in and maybe being new distribution or whatever. Like there is a lot of interesting innovation. So, but you're getting me to think of something else. So just talking about my stresses of dealing with anything that's not cyber insurance, I see folks talking a lot about kind of overlap between tech and cyber, or difference between tech and cyber, or it just seems like it's a common conversation. I was just at a conference last week where they were talking about it. I've never liked tech insurance very much. I find it confusing. I like cyber. I just stick in my lane. But like, what are your thoughts?
I got into cyber because of tech insurance. So I first did, as a lawyer coming up the ranks at like a litigation firm, they handled claims against software developers or MSPs or other types of organizations that were technology service providers, and there were disputes with their customers, and it was a lot of basic professional-ish negligence claims. And it was a really exciting area. And then that ended up sort of falling into or getting married, coupled with the cyber covers, where most of the standalone cyber policies have the first party and the third party, where there's this defense for technology errors and omissions, it is related. It is different, as you know. So the issues that arise are different. Most of the tech, claims that we handle for carriers are about like a botched implementation of a new software for a company. We've had where the software development has not gone to consumer expectations. We've had it where there's been technology products that haven't worked. We've had, with the rise of ransomware, we have the claims against MSP. Managed security service providers, where this failure to prevent theory is coming up a lot against tech companies. We have them where there's more of an express contract. So the technology company is providing a service, and then we learn in an investigation that it was the failure of that technology company in providing those exact services that was the causal nexus of the compromise. And those are very challenging liability cases. Mm. And so I love technology liability. These are all wartime type of scenarios. We also do the counseling. So the best use of legal spend for a tech company is before there's a lawsuit or a claim or an event. So that's, in that regard, have your own terms and conditions set up the right way. Make sure your contract documents are there, and you have your own controls. Make sure you're following some sort of cybersecurity standard like NIST or ISO or something. Mm-hmm. Just marry your own services to a standard so you can state one day how you aim to do your services and how you do your work. So a lot of it is, under the law in the United States, interestingly, tech professionals are not considered to be licensed professionals in the way a doctor or an architect is. Instead, they're considered to be quasi professionals, more akin to a specialist. And so they're held to a different standard, a higher standard than the average business that's just selling widgets.
Okay. Interesting. Well, I think, I think what you say about the reasons you like tech is probably the reasons it stresses me.
Well, you're a tech entrepreneur yourself, so I get it.
I can only think of the bad sides of a lot of that. But it's definitely on the technical side of stuff and trying to understand what's going on. And then once it starts to get too far into liability, I always thought, before I got into insurance, I always thought, oh, I could be a lawyer. I could learn this stuff. I think it'd be really interesting. And then I started working in insurance, and then I realized, I'm gonna stay in my lane a little bit. I think that's kind of hard for me to understand what's going on there some of the time. So it's changed my viewpoint. We were talking a bit earlier, around ransomware negotiation. Like you guys do a lot of, as you said, kind of wartime incident response. Dealing with breaches and dealing with incidents. What are some of the things you've seen? Now, I know we talked about negotiations, but some of the things you've seen that are really effective at dealing with ransomware, like after it's happened, like what are some of your opinions on that?
Communications is key. I mean, it's key and it's king. If you have a deliberate plan on how to communicate what's happening to the people that need it to be communicated to. That gets you a really long way. And we find that thinking through the comms is a process that we add a lot of value. A lot of times our clients haven't started to think about that issue. We're raising it for the first time. Other times the clients, well, they thought about it all right, and they did all the things wrong. You know, just as an example, I think of kind of a little bit of levity, you know, we have sort of a canned line that we give to our clients. Look, you really should not use the word breach. And breach is a word that's got a legal context to it, and you don't want people to misconstrue it. So just don't use the word breach. You know, we have that conversation a lot. We have a lot of other do's and don'ts words.
Yeah.
That we share with our clients. But we always say, you know, try not to use the word attack, you know, call it an event. You know, we try to soften some of the language when we talk about comms. Well, I recently had a matter, and I'm interviewing the client, first time I met them, and I'm going through it, and I said, oh, so have you told anybody about this? Have you shared this with your employees, with your He's like, oh yeah, we've been sending emails to all of our customers since the minute we became aware of this. I was like, oh, well, what have you said? And he said, I said that we were attacked by a foreign ransomware attacker, and that we had a massive data breach, and we would keep filling them in as soon as we knew what was going on. And I just smiled, because it was like all the things not to do, to say, you know. So I'm like, all right, well, we'll try to work with what you got. Send us those communications, and let's see if we can, you know, work with them. So, it's funny that I think that is the key to a solid IR response, especially ransomware, because ransomware really is the whole, you know, house on fire, and you need to start getting fire, you know, the firefighters there as quickly as possible. So, but if you control the message, especially with the consumer, so for a lot of our clients have consumers that are affected when they get hit. So you can control that message, you can own that story. And then you can conform the ultimate compliance issues to the story that you've been telling, or vice versa. So I think that's very important. We divide the world between internal stakeholders, external stakeholders, and we ask our clients to give that very serious thought, and we try to add more value. Sometimes we work with other external resources like public relations consultants, but sometimes we give the client the tools to do it themselves. It really depends on the situation.
Yeah. I guess circling back a little bit to the comms point. It is funny, some of the things I've seen, and don't hold on. You know, it is that instinct to kind of want to immediately jump out and tell everybody and say, oh yeah, it's a breach, and the kind of issues people cause themselves with some of that. All right. Well, let me change direction a little bit, just on, you know, talking about things in the news, kind of fourth party risk. You know, it's kind of a hot topic right now.
That's it.
What are your thoughts?
I feel like every news media cyber story really does involve some sort of aspect of fourth party risk. What do I mean by fourth party risk? If you look at it either upstream or downstream, if you're looking at it upstream, it's, again, let's say your policyholder hires a IT services company to do their IT, like outsourced IT. Well, what they, maybe your policyholder hadn't thought of, is that the IT provider that they hired gets a lot of its IT assets and resources from a hosting company that has no relationship with their customers. And if something happens to the hosting company, in other words, the hosting company gets hit with ransomware, well, then the IT services provider is affected. But then, and that's a third party to the hosting company, but then the IT service providers, consumers, your policyholder. Well, now that's a fourth party that gets affected by the incident. And if you're looking at it, so again, upstream and downstream. So it's either the hosting company is the fourth party to the policyholder, or the policyholder in this case is the fourth party to the hosting company. Either way, there's a lot less control that the client has in the risks associated with those fourth parties than they do over the third parties. Because if I hire you to be my vendor, I can make you in the contract agree provide me with regular updates about your security. Give me a copy of your insurance policy. I want to audit your ISO compliance. I can ask for all of that in a contract.
Yeah.
And if you say yes, then you're committing to having those standards and complying with those standards. And so I can control that relationship pretty well.
Yeah.
Well, I know who they're using as a hosting company or their telecom provider or any other fourth party that's up the chain. How do I even know?
Yeah.
These are very challenging issues.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, as you said, you know, you don't even know that they're there. You know, so much less controlling it in the sense of being able to tell them what to do. You know, it's kind of one of those, it's a hidden risk. Is there anything kind of going on that you've seen that's a good example of that?
A good example of mitigating that risk, or a good example of where that's happening?
Where it's actually happening, like what you're seeing.
Yeah, I'm only smiling because it's in the past. But we had a very challenging case, and the tech company, and they provided services for a particular industry sector. So all of their clients were companies that did business in one industry sector. So the services that my client was providing was specific to this industry sector, but they were technological services, and essentially what I'll call data processing.
Okay.
And so they were processing data for all of these companies in one industry sector. And it was the exact scenario I hit. My client's hosting company was affected by ransomware, and that brought my client down. And as a result, my client was unable to fulfill its data processing obligations to all of its hundreds of consumers in this one industry sector, which is a highly regulated sector. What it was, I guess, aware of, but it hadn't accounted for, and certainly as the breach counsel, I was like, that's interesting. You know, that there's a wrinkle. Was one of my client's consumers was not in that industry sector, was not a company within that industry sector. It was what it described itself as a reseller of the same data processing services that my client provided. And so essentially, okay, they just white labeled and resold my client's services to their own set of consumers, same industry sector. Okay. And now instead of like 200 or 300, it's now like 400 or 500. Those are fourth parties that were affected. So 200 of my own client's third party consumers. And then with respect to one consumer, there were another 100 or 200 fourth party consumers that were then affected. And so that was extremely challenging because all of those companies had their own lawyers, and we had to have all these meetings, and we did town halls to communicate information. It was a very challenging experience. Mm-hmm. But it was a great illustration of fourth party risk in digital supply chain in this area.
Yeah, there's probably a nice crossover with insurance we could get into, but I think we've kind of gone through all the time we had for the thought leadership questions. So one thing I do like to ask, you know, there's a couple of questions I'd like to ask before we close out. I think we get some really interesting answers. How did you end up in insurance or legal? Either one.
I became a lawyer because I can't sing or dance.
So you became a lawyer, cannot sing or dance. And then that was what led you into this industry, I guess.
Like a lot of lawyers, when you're starting out in your career, you don't really get to pick the type of cases that you work on. You're just given cases. If you work in a big law firm, they just hand you cases and you have to. And then if you do well, they give you more. And if you don't do well, they give you less. Right. So I mentioned earlier, I kind of fell into cyber because I was doing a lot of tech. So I came up the ranks of a insurance services law firm. They did all kinds of legal work for the insurance industry, coverage and litigation and monitoring and all kinds of work. And they did a lot of litigation. And I was good at architects and engineer, design professional liability, and technology liability. And
okay,
I kind of fell into it because it was the tech E&O claim that used to be basically an A&E claim. And when cyber came out, it fell into the cyber umbrella, and I was at the right place at the right time.
Okay. Interesting. Cool. Last question then. What would you recommend to anyone who wants to have a successful career as a lawyer? Or is anything else? Like, if you just want to broaden it out, happy to do that too.
Yeah. Well, when you're first starting out, you have to understand that you don't know anything. And it's very hard for someone who's come up through college and law school and being able to achieve a lot of academic achievements, et cetera, to take a step back and realize that you don't know as much as other people and you need to learn.
Yeah.
So a lot of in the beginning, it's you should be quiet and observe.
Yeah.
Learn the terrain. Start there. That's okay. A good opening advice to young lawyers or anyone starting out in a young profession. And then from there, follow, be likable. Don't be an asshole. It sounds like common sense advice, but
you say that. I had the hardest time with that when I was starting out because it's very opinionated and very demanding of myself and other people. I was not easy. So don't be an asshole is great advice.
Yeah. It's I think lawyers particularly have difficulty checking that.
Yeah.
I think you get more bees with honey in the long run. I think you never know who's going to be your future business partner, your future client, future judge. There's folks that I litigated with early in my career who are Superior Court judges in New Jersey right now. And so I hope I was professional to those folks. Other career advice. Also be responsive. Like honestly, the single most positive, the most frequent feedback that we get from our group is how incredibly responsive we are. We don't let too long go by without an answer to your question. It seems like an easy one, but you'd be surprised. And so you get a lot by just being responsive. Some other advice for young professionals.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks a lot for telling us a bit about yourself and your thoughts.
This is awesome.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Great.
Anthony.
It's been great having you on.
All right. We love your show. So
thanks. Thanks.
Check a lot. Out. Well,
great. Well, you, I hope you have a good evening and a good, well, I guess it's still early for you, but, and a good weekend.
Thanks, man. You too.
If you want to learn more about our host, Anthony, or his company, Aceris, visit aceris.com. aceris.com. Thanks to our friends at Sawoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.